You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
James Baldwin once said about movie stars, "One does not go to see them act, one goes to watch them be." In his latest book, film historian and critic James Harvey analyzes how we watch these strangers we call stars, watching them be star presence on the screen. From Garbo to Balthazar is published by Faber and Faber, and I'm very pleased to welcome James Harvey back to our show. Hi.
Thank you.
Are you making a point by opening with Greta Garbo and ending at least your title with a donkey?
Yes. I was saying last night in another venue that the two things that were certain about this book when I began it was that it would begin with Garbo and it would end with Balthazar, and everything else fell into place over time.
But since this is about having some kind of presence, does Balthazar,
right,
who is the character in one of the most depressing movies I've ever seen by Robert Bresson, does the Balthazar have presence, or is the little girl who is really the star of that film the one with the presence?
Well, really, the Balthazar film is about presence, and it's about his presence more than anything else. He's the background to the human affairs in the movie, which I'm sure depressed you when you saw.
Well, he's not treated well.
No, and so I mean it's totally the subject of my book is totally relevant to that film, and it is my favorite film, as I say in the book.
There is an old saying that you should avoid being in scenes with animals because they always upstage the humans.
Yes, and he totally upstages everybody while being, you know, being relatively passive. The humans are the active ones, alas, in the course of the story.
Although there was an experiment done in Russia, famous experiment in
yes.
which the actor was totally passive, and we read stuff.
Yes,
we read stuff into him based yes. on the context of the editing.
Right.
Does that work in general? Is that one of the ways that people develop a sense of stars develop their presence?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, reactions to the stars on screen are always important, but I think that in spite of that experience, it's not the central thing, I think, for a real experience of star presence. And with Balthazar, they mostly ignore him, mistreat him or ignore him, and but the film makes certain that we notice that we feel that we experience it.
Why do some actors seem to exude a sense of presence more than others?
Well, I think one of the things the book offers to be about, what I wanted to write about in the book, was the sense of mystery that comes from presences on the screen, and that's why I began with Garbo, because you know she is sort of the embodiment of star presence and was at the time and has been ever since. She's almost equivalent to mystery on the screen.
How much of that was because of her, and how much of that was because of the way she was lit, of the directors who directed her, the people who wrote the really great scripts for her, her co-stars?
Well, it was totally, I mean, it was something that was manufactured before the camera, behind the camera. That's one of the first section of my book is called Icons, and it's about earlier Hollywood stars in the days when they knew how to do mystery.
Do we have icons today?
Yeah, we have Balthazar. We have today. I'm not so sure, Leonard. Today it is more confused. But in the period I begin the book in, the Garbo period, more or less, it was controlled. I mean, it was the studios ran the movies and the studios ran the stars pretty much. I think Garbo was a little bit of a surprise to MGM, but they knew what they had. And they never let her act for anybody else or appear for anyone else.
Well, you write about her performance in Ninotchka, where she, directed by the great Ernst Lubitsch, 1939.
Yes, indeed.
You say that there was, we're won over when Garbo knits her brows. What makes that moment so memorable?
Well, because it's her, and because I'm not sure what the reference, image or scene the reference refers to, but
well, you say that Garbo was able to make meaning before your eyes.
Yeah, I mean we read her face as we read the faces. I think that's partly James Baldwin's point. As we read the faces of the stars, we're totally absorbed in those faces and in those presences.
You also read about Marlene Dietrich, who actually precedes Garbo in the movies. But I was thinking about the directors that they worked with. Marlene Dietrich comes to prominence working with Joseph von Sternberg, who's a much darker director than Ernst Lubitsch, who had the famous Lubitsch touch. Do you think that affects the way we perceive them and the kind of charisma that they had?
What affects the way we perceive
them? The people who made them
put
them on the screen and gave them the kinds of roles that they got.
Absolutely. When I talk about Bette Davis, I talk about her films with Wyler. And when I talk about John Wayne, I talk mainly about his films with John Ford. Of course, yes. Garbo was, she didn't have a single progenitor, as it were, but she was controlled. It's another mystery what results from that control.
But I gather that when she was signed by F.W. Murnau to appear in a film when she was an unknown, he'd seen her in a Swedish film where she had just been luminous. And when he was shooting her, he couldn't figure out why she didn't look so good in any of the takes. And so he called the Swedish director, and he said, well, what did you do there? Was there some kind of special lighting? And he said, yes, and I'll tell you it if you pay me a certain price. So Murnau bought the secret and then published it so that director could never do that again. But everybody lit Garbo in a certain way from that time on.
Uh-huh.
You hadn't heard that story?
No, I have not. I've never heard that. No, not at all.
But so in this case, and Marlene Dietrich was famous for knowing just where the key light should be when she was being filmed. So lighting actually plays a role in how we perceive these people.
Dietrich could have photographed herself. She was so expert at that. You know, he was quite extraordinary in that way, you know. Everybody worked with her. I mean, she was the one who controlled the way she appeared after Sternberg, but he was the one who showed her how, who began before he got into trouble and got fired. You know?
What were the criteria for choosing the actors and directors you write about in this book? And as you said, you pair them in many cases.
Yeah. Well, the criterion was criteria were how much they interested me, whether I'd written about them before. I had always wanted to write about Garbo, and I'd never really written so much about John Wayne, and I wanted to do that. And then I write about Robert De Niro extensively too.
Somebody who I wouldn't necessarily think of as having that kind of charisma.
Well, the book is in three parts, and the first part is about the icons, as I call them, and then the second part, and then there's a development in audiences and in the expectations of audiences. Movies become after the war, well after the war, World War II, they become more realistic. That's what audiences wanted and expected, and there was a way in which for the great film critics like André Bazin, which realism became partly because of the impact of neorealism in Italy, the Rossellini and De Sica and so on. The idea of mystery in the movies and mysterious presences is connected partly due to Godard to increase more intense realism, a more intense sense of real life.
One of the actors you write about is Ingrid Bergman.
Yes.
Who has who fits into a number of the different categories.
Yes, she does. Yeah. Well, first, she's a great Hollywood star, the successor to Garbo, as some people said at the time. And then
was that partly because she was Swedish? Or?
Yes, I think so. But also because she made such an impact, and people were looking for a successor to Garbo when they wrote about film.
Do you see her as a transitional figure between the icons and the realists?
Oh, yes. Well, yes, because she went to Italy and she started making movies with Rossellini, was one of the founders of neorealism, and these movies are very strange and very uncommercial in terms of the American audience.
Well, in Casablanca, isn't she still giving a relatively realistic performance?
Yes, but that's what she always did, I think. She always gave realistic performances. She was not as mannered as earlier stars have been, not as mannered as Garbo could be.
Although she winds up making comparisons with Garbo in very early, a little ad that she did?
Ad?
Yeah, well, I have I've lost that reference here, so I'm working off the top of my head, unfortunately. Oh, yeah, Ginger Ale. She recited a line of Garbo's once in 1941 when she signed with MGM. It involved ginger ale.
Oh, it's the first
line. I got it from your book.
Yeah, it's the first line of Anna Christie, mm-hmm. The first line that Anna has in the play and in the two movie versions. But it's in the script. It's in the play and in the script. Mm-hmm. Eugene O'Neill wrote the line for Anna Christie, and so yes, and what we're referring to is she did Anna Christie on the stage when she first came to America. Selznick set that up for her in California. She did Anna Christie on the stage, and she says in her autobiography that people laughed at the idea of her playing this part. It was perfect for Garbo, it seemed at the time, but then for her to succeed in the role and to say that line, which is "Give me a whiskey with ginger ale on the side,"
Drama,
to a bartender.
The drama critic Stark Young described the golden age of Hollywood cinema as real life but different, and that difference was what you call acting.
Yes.
You agree?
Yes.
Do you think that when you meet some of these stars, or when people met some of these stars off screen, did they still have that charisma? How much of that charisma is of our own invention and putting it into them because we have been their fans?
Well, it's partly, of course, they depend on us for that, and so do the people who shape the images apart from the star. They depend on our response. It's very complicated, and finally, I think, mysterious, like the question of what makes a presence. You know? But human beings are mysterious, and that's partly the point of this phenomenon and this art form. You know?
Well, the art form is also mysterious in other ways. It goes from the silent era into sound, and there's a transition there. And then there's the golden age, a different transition, and then the transition into realism. Where are we now?
Well, where my book goes is into a kind of it's really about the way the movies are a sort of quasi-religious experience, and the parallel between the movie experience and religious experience of worship, even in the dark before an image and so forth, icons and is something I develop in the book, and that's why I thought I always meant for it to end with Balthazar, which is an intensely, though not secularly, religious film. And also the films that Ingrid Bergman did with Rossellini are more obliquely, but clearly have a religious subject theme.
What do you think made Betty Davis so popular? She could be called a realistic actor, but she got very mannered.
Oh, she did get very mannered, yeah. I write mainly about her three films with William Wyler, The Little Foxes and Jezebel and The Letter. All three are just magnificent films, and she is extraordinary in all three of them. And I don't think you could call her mannered, but she was out. She was what I mean, try to ignore Betty Davis. I mean, she was, once she made her impact on the screen, she was, you know, and then she developed a lot of bad habits, which she fought with her directors over. She thought that the kind of excess that she practiced in some of her films was what her fans wanted. She said that, you know. She said, you can, if you want to see real behavior, you can see it anywhere. You know?
You write about Robert Altman's Nashville.
Yes.
Do you see that as the ultimately realistic film?
Well, it's not. I see it as a beautiful illustration of the power of star presence, because there are so many extraordinary people in it, and often very briefly. But he knows what he's got in his two main leading ladies, and they are just extraordinary, you know.
One of them we don't see much, or haven't seen much since.
Ronnie Blakely. Yeah. She didn't have a good career after that, but we see Lily Tomlin certainly still, and she's still wonderful.
But you also say everybody kind of loves Barbara Jean, the character played by Ronnie Blakely.
Yeah, Altman instructed his cast that they didn't get on too well, he and Ronnie Blakely apparently, but he instructed his cast that everybody in their fictional characters would love Barbara Jean, and she is, of course, the tragic figure at the center of the film.
In this book, you write about both popular mainstream movies and art films. Is there a common denominator?
Well, of course, I hope it's in the subject of the book, which is this mysterious star presence, this mysterious star phenomenon. Partly the point about Nashville is that Ronnie Blakely is a star, and yet she's not the kind of manufactured star that used to occur in movies and that we expected from movies. We don't get from Nashville, we get these flashes of brilliance and so on. The same is true with Pam Grier and Jackie Brown, which I also write about. She's extraordinary and unforgettable.
Well, she's a real presence in real life as well.
I have never met her. I'm sure she is.
Today, who would you say are the old-fashioned stars? Somebody like Tom Cruise?
No. No. I don't think, well, somebody like, I mean, you think of Betty Davis, you might think of Meryl Streep.
George Clooney?
Yeah, I think George Clooney is very much like, he's reminiscent, as people have said, of Clark Gable in many ways. And he's very smart and very good. Yeah.
James Harvey's book is called Watching Them Be, Star Presence in the Screen from Garbo to Balthazar. It's a follow-up to his classic books, movie Love in the 50s and Romantic Comedy in Hollywood. It's published by Faber and Faber. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.